Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Seventy percent of workers say that performance management processes simply don't work. And with one third of workers leaving their jobs every year, how can leaders and managers get the most from their teams while keeping them engaged? Joining me today on All About Business is Octavius Black, the founder and CEO of MindGym. He merges behavioral science with leadership development. In today's episode, we discuss the psychology behind high performance, why leadership programs are a waste of time, and the six-step process for transforming your teams. What a wonderful name for a business. I'm going to ask my first question to you, Octavius, is why MindGym? But just to give a little explanation, it's very much focused on learning and development in business. And you founded the company, as I understand, in 2001 and floated it on the AIM public market in 2018. So you've had 25 years now in business, quite a journey. But let's begin. Why MindGym? Why did you call it that? What does it do?
It started off, dare I say, at a slightly drunken dinner. We were looking at each decade and what it had peaked at. So we thought the 80s with Jane Fonda and jogging and exercise taking other than for sport was kind of the decade of the body. And then we looked at the 90s, it had yoga and feng shui and alternative medicine became massive. But maybe that's the decade of the soul or the spirit. And then we thought, what would be next? Well, mind, body, soul is an obvious trinity. So we thought the next decade could be the decade of the mind. And so we thought, in that case, why not create a mind gym?
That's really interesting. So that's pretty big picture stuff.
And we came up with this thought and then went out to physical gyms. And right. The idea was, in order to get people's attention in a gym, you couldn't last for anything longer than 90 minutes. Everyone thought at those days that to learn anything useful, you need to spend a day doing it, which is clearly absurd now and was ridiculous then. But we came up with the idea of doing a 90-minute workout.
Well, because in a physical gym.
In a physical gym.
That's the maximum.
So you do kickboxing and then you might do conflict handling.
Right.
So we take.
Oh, so you did both in the gym.
That was the idea.
Oh, I see.
So we went out to all these gyms to push this idea and it was a complete disaster. They could not have been less interested. The only way the modeling worked out was if you had zero marketing costs, zero winning business costs, you filled every session and then you broke even. So this was clearly not a business model.
So you began by thinking that people who like kickboxing would also like conflict resolution.
They could do the mind and the body in the same place.
I preferred the fighting, I don't know.
My background had been as a management consultant, and I'd seen lots of recommendations not succeed because businesses didn't think of the human dimension. So you'd have this fantastically clever strategy, brilliant analysis, but then it would flop because people weren't on board, they weren't engaged, you weren't using the psychology of behavior in order to get people to sign up and commit to things. So I thought, why don't we spin this and turn it on business and go to businesses and say, why don't we run a mind gym for you so your people are more engaged, more committed and faster at change and perform better?
And did you still stay with the 90-minute format?
We did indeed. Very importantly, the BBC was so skeptical about it, they ran a study to compare our 90-minute session with a day-long session and found that our 90-minute session actually outperformed the day on 4 out of 5 measures, plus saving everyone 4/5 of their day. So the case for it became pretty compelling after that.
That's very satisfying. So why was it that the 90-minute approach outperformed?
We rethought what learning is about. So traditionally, people thought you had to have a set of learning objectives. You had to move at the pace of the slowest learner. You had to make sure everyone covered everything. We're like, no, this is not how people learn. And what you want to do is to stretch people. So they have to think a little higher, go a little beyond. And therefore, you pack the session with a day's worth of content. And people would pick the 2 or 3 things they found most useful. And then we never have anyone sitting and listening for more than 6 minutes at a time. So you're constantly doing things. It's a gym, after all. So you're doing exercise. I'll give you an example. We have a very popular session called Influence and Persuade. Sitting in horseshoe chairs and on alternate seats is a pen. And you come and you sit down. And before even the introduction, you said, those of you either got a pen or you're sitting next to someone without a pen. I'd like you to pair up. And the one without the pen has to persuade the person with the pen to give them the pen.
Right.
And after 2 or 3 minutes, some of them have and some of them haven't. You're like, why did you persuade? What worked? What didn't? The way to persuade people is to appeal to their interests, not your own, for example.
Right.
So you're moving.
So what's the best example of that you came across? Have you got one?
Years ago, pitching to a bank called UBS, and we're pitching to the HR people and the directors of this and that and that, and suddenly the big cheese comes in, and he's like the absolute authority, and everyone goes silent and quietly turns up. And she said, okay, tell me what you've got. So I started telling him about influence and persuade. Mm. And in kind of status move, he stands up, turns his back on me and starts pouring coffee. So like in that moment, I could have just carried on talking. But if I did, I kind of lost him. Mm. So I go silent. He said, no, carry on. I said, no, don't worry. We'll wait until you've done the coffee. So finally, he turns to the other people in the room. He hasn't spoken.
You say mine's a cappuccino at this point.
All comes in a moment.
So then what happened? Yeah.
So then he says, do you want a coffee? So I say, yeah. They say no. I say yes. And he gives me the coffee. Obviously, I don't drink it because that's all part of the status
game. Oh, right. You know this stuff. Yeah. You don't drink it then.
So he's done the effort. He's had to serve me. But then I haven't seen it worth my while to consume it. Then he looks at me and says, what do you got that's so good? I said, we have this great session on influence and persuade. He asks this fantastic question. He asks me, he says, are you using it on me now? Which is really clever, because if I say yes, he can go, it's not working. And if I go no, he says, well, if it's so good, why aren't you using it? So what I said is the answer is yes, and we'll find out if it works at the end of this meeting. And he kind of smiled and thought, okay, we're on the same level here. And sure enough, they ended up becoming a client and we went from there.
I like that. You've got to think on your feet, though.
But that's what Mind Gym's all about. You're talking in pairs, you're doing an exercise, you're answering a quiz, there's something going on the whole time. So you're not sitting with a boring lecture or boring video of someone. You're actually taking part in exercises and trying things out. See, how would I apply this? Or what is the blocker that's stopping me from doing something?
And how many people would be in a typical group?
Typical group, about 20 people if it's in person and about 16 people if it's virtual.
Right.
We also run large sessions like TED Talks on speed, and they can fill the whole stadiums. And we also do one-to-one coaching. Coaching's really interesting because coaching can transform or it can make you worse, and you don't know which until it's too late.
So tell me about that. So why is that? How does that work?
Well, you confuse likability with performance improvement. So a very interesting study in the States, the largest study of upward feedback is students rating their faculty. And you can also measure students' performance on their exams at the beginning of the year and at the end of the year. So the question is, what is the relationship between how students rate their faculty and how they do in their exams? And the answer is, after a point, they are inversely correlated. So the more you like your professor, the less well you do or improve in your exams. Because the professor is very likable. James, fantastic essay. A few facts aren't quite what I thought. And I never heard that view before, but I love your originality. Mm. Well, James, you can't get your facts right. You come up with a hypothesis that no one's coming in 100 years. Get back to work. And the first one, you really like the advice. That's really helpful. The second one, you think, actually, I don't like this person at all, but you work doubly hard. So what we found with coaching is often the coach wants to be very likable because that's how they get more business.
Right.
James, you're doing a fantastic job. Does your boss really know how good you are?
Maybe I never get feedback like this.
Well, you hired a coach, you might well.
I've got shareholders. And my professor was pretty blunt as well.
That's why you've done so well.
I don't know. I think I do respond more to sort of getting a bit of a shove than being told I'm marvellous, I think. Because that makes me think, I've got to show you.
Well, a good coach will do that.
Yeah.
But most coaches want to be liked, rather like the professors, rather than to change behavior. Right. And so we developed a new methodology called precision coaching, which is all about driving performance. And it's shown time and again to get better performance results.
So what buttons does a precision coach push, Octavius?
First of all, they imagine what you get you to imagine what good enough would look like.
Right.
So in cognitive behavioral therapy, or in actually in all psychotherapy, one of the most successful versions of it is success-based therapy. So you imagine what good enough would look like. And we start with that. And then we work out what are the things that are getting in the way, and therefore what are the first steps you can take. And we do a 4x45-minute journey. So you start off defining the problem, what good enough looks like. You work out what's getting in the way. You have a go at trying to fix that. You work out the next thing's getting in the way, you have a go at fixing that. And then you finally finish off, and then you work out you've got good enough at something before you move on to the next thing and repeat the cycle. So the worst thing you can do in the coaching session is say, what's on your mind today? Or where should we start? What you need to do is to have a structure which says, this is the goal we're going after. This is what good enough looks like. Now let's work out the steps that get you there.
So coaching in that sense sounds quite distinct from therapy, say, yes, or analysis. Totally.
It's performance coaching.
Is that similar to sports or is it different in business?
Well, there are similarities and there are big differences. I mean, often people talk about sporting analogies.
Well, I know. And I've always been a bit sort of unsure about that. Yeah.
You're right to be unsure.
Oh, good. I wasn't very good at sports. Yeah. But I want to be good at what I'm doing now.
Well,
I mean, so why am I right to be unsure? What's
because sport mainly takes place in a very defined period of time, between 10 seconds and 90 minutes. You practice a lot beforehand. You then get on the pitch or the field and you do whatever it is that's required. And you're doing the same thing broadly this every time, or very similar, with a very defined group of people.
I mean, the world's not like that.
Business is constant.
Yeah,
you don't turn off. You don't practice. You might rehearse a pitch or something like that.
Yes.
But in the main, you're on the whole time. If you've got a large business, you don't even meet most of the people. Your individual contribution, obviously, you're in a slightly different situation. But for most people, most businesses, their individual contribution isn't moving the dial in a massive way. But their combined effort is what's moving it. So you have to think of it almost like an infinite game. And when it never stops, you never get to that wonderful Sonny Upton, the CEO, does this big speech saying, you've done a brilliant job. It's very tough. We're going to do these changes, right. Then it will all be wonderful. But then it will all be wonderful is a complete myth. It's not how business works. You're constantly
evolving. No, because it's always tomorrow.
Yeah. But sport does have an end. You win a gold medal, or you get the Championship League Cup or whatever it happens to be.
We're delighted that you're listening to this episode. Hit the follow button so that we can continue to bring you the best business insight to help your business and or career.
That's quite insightful, I think, because the sort of always-on aspect of work and life is very apparent to me. And yet we have this sort of, this conversation. I mean, it's been brilliantly portrayed in the TV series Severance about sort of somehow compartmentalizing work from things. What do you think about
that? I think Severance is brilliant. It's an absolutely genius program. And I think actually we blurred the lines between home and work too much. And as a result, we're making too many demands on each other, whether you're an employer or employee.
Right.
So the employee says, for example, I'm not feeling very well. I'm feeling exhausted. It's work's fault. And work is saying, in order to be part of this, you have to work, bring your whole self to work. And every part of your life is part of your working
life.
Be
totally authentic and present and all of that.
All incredibly unhelpful.
Is it?
Yes.
So why is all that incredibly unhelpful?
Because you're a different person at home from your work, and there are different skills and attributes you bring, and you want to keep those two things separate. So we talk a bit about depoliticizing the workplace,
right.
And diversity and inclusion has become a hot topic at the moment, partly because of Trump's executive orders, partly because of the Supreme Court ruling. And actually what you want to do is you want to depoliticize work. You and I might be getting on tremendously well creating new products, and then we discover we have different view on trade or immigration or Israel, Palestine, and the debate of the working relationship between us gets massively destroyed by that effect because we feel very strongly about these issues. And that's really unhelpful for the business, and it's really unhelpful for our work. So what we're very much encouraging companies to do is to remove the politics, not need to take a strong stance on issues that don't relate to the company itself, and create an environment where people from all different backgrounds, all different beliefs, all different pathologies can work in harmony for the benefit of the company.
I think that's something sort of very important there about having a common purpose, a shared objective. And I also think that, I mean, in our business, I've always talked about inclusion and belonging. I want everyone to feel that they are welcome in the business, that they can give their best in the business, that they belong here, and they're, you know, whatever background you're from. So I think it's so important to bring people together, you know, behind a common objective or common purpose. But are we getting better or worse at that as a business community?
It ranges. So some pioneering companies are getting brilliant at this because they recognize that the things that polarize people are best not included. And therefore, they avoid some of the diversity and equity and inclusion language and stances and some of the focus on different kinds of representation targets. And they are focusing much more on what we can do to create, your word, belonging. So how can we say, whoever you are, if you're talented and you're committed and you want to achieve what we're trying to do as a business, you are welcome here. So we're working with one company that's short on engineers. And engineers tend to overrepresent in neurodiversity. So they're like, well, we've got to go to these engineers. And actually, we're not a great environment for neurodiverse people to work. So we need to change that so we can hire more of these great engineers. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Other companies are still caught up in the one company we've got. It's got 180 different employee resource groups who've represent different criteria, whether it's vegans or menopause or
180.
And they don't think this is the limit, to much of their chagrin. So what we're doing is we're helping them focus and coordinate those in order to get the benefit of a few that really bring people together and that help to address business problems. So for example, working with a pharmaceutical company that has a low level of Asian women taking part in clinical trials. And that's a big issue because then they're creating drugs that don't necessarily work for Asian women. So they're going to the employee resource group and saying, can you help us solve this business problem? What can we do about it? I know another who's failed to get market penetration in certain markets. Everyone's just had no one from those markets on the project team. So where you use diversity and inclusion to further a business objective, you know, representing who comes to clinical trials or understand your audience, it's a really important thing to do. And there are lots of ways you can build belonging, partly by helping people value variety in its infinite sense. So we've, for example, got companies to talk less about protected characteristics and more about headwinds and tailwinds. So headwinds are the things you're born with that made life pretty tough, and tailwinds are the ones you're born with that made life a lot easier. We tend to overestimate our own headwinds. I had it really tough. And underestimate everybody else's. James, you had it really easy. A lovely family, very upbringing.
Thank you.
And actually, if we...
you don't know. I mean, it's the truth. You don't know anything about someone who's just sitting opposite you. And,
you don't.
I mean, they might have had all sorts of things going on in their life, even
100%
day before.
So the headwinds and tailwinds becomes really important.
So you, when you sort of conceptualize that, are you trying to get people to think about that more in other people?
Yes.
So you're trying to make people aware of headwinds and tailwinds as a concept.
Cue empathy.
Yeah.
And empathy about the individual rather than about the category. So rather than all women or all black people or whatever category it is, is actually thinking about the individual and saying, how can I understand them better? And what can I do to help them be belonging, included, part of the
program? All you can do in the end, because you're going to be sitting opposite Octavius or Frankie or Will, and they're the people in your world. So that's the best place to start.
We work with a very interesting psychologist called Lasana Harris out of UCL, and he ran an experiment in a school in Chicago where the kids, the black kids, were getting more detentions than the white kids. So the traditional thing to do is to show the data to the teachers and say, stop being racist. He's like, I'm not sure that's going to work, because there are a lot of psychological effects like backfire and backlash and stuff. It basically means that's very unlikely to succeed, even though that's how most D&I programs tend to work. And instead, he got them to say, well, why did you become a teacher? And they all basically say the same thing. I wanted to help kids grow, get the best chance in life. What would make you, James, the best teacher you could be? Well, again, they all say pretty much the same thing. I teach each child individually, get to know them where they are. And that was pretty much all he did. Racial discrimination for detentions dropped by 45% within 6 weeks and continued low for the next rest of that school year and the next school year. So you've sidelined the effect of bias, even if you haven't necessarily changed how these teachers think. That's where psychology becomes really clever.
So what you're saying is, well, the teacher took more time to know each individual as a person rather than just categorizing them.
In effect, they reinforced their identity. Why did I become a teacher? And professional excellence. And then they got to empathize with each individual. So recognizing, in the empathy, is what was it like that kid doing homework? Well, do they have a quiet place, or do they have to compete with noise? Was like getting up in the morning to someone out their clothes and give them breakfast, or do they have to get themselves up? And then suddenly little Tommy turning up 5 minutes late, instead of saying, how dare you be 5 minutes late? It's like, you made it in. Only 5 minutes late.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you had more empathy.
So excellence in what you're doing and empathy.
Yes.
As bedfellows in a sense.
Exactly.
So, I mean, HR is the world I operate in many ways as a recruiter. And obviously many of our clients and customers work in HR. And I'm a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Personnel Development. So I'm very interested in the future of HR. But you've got some sort of interesting insight that I think you should share with our
listeners. I'm very
happy
to do so.
Come on, far away.
Far away. That I think that there's lots of excellence in pockets in HR. So there's some really great HR professionals who are very driven by numbers, data, and evidence and outcomes. And that's exceptional. But overall, en masse, the report card is not that impressive. So since 2007, spending on HR has gone up by 35%. The UK has the second highest HR spend as a percentage of payroll in the Western world, second only to the Netherlands. And probably in the whole world, the data doesn't show the rest of the world outside the West. And then on top of that, we're seeing productivity has barely shifted in the UK. It's a few percentage points higher than it was in 2007. We're seeing absenteeism at an all-time high, sickness at an all-time high. We're increasingly seeing people doing two or three jobs simultaneously, full-time jobs, and no one even noticing. So well, I think there's all
that's
sorts
pretty
of...
pretty bad.
It's not good, is it?
No, that's a bad call sheet. Yeah.
The outcomes are not great. So I think the intent is really good, but quite a lot of tendency to follow fads rather than facts. And therefore, we find that 40% of initiatives that started never actually see the light of day. Now, there's a $200 million on digital licenses for learning libraries that aren't used. So you have an enormous amount of waste because it seems like an interesting or fun thing to do, or because everyone else is doing it, or because it's the fad of the moment.
So the $200 million, what people have been given this to spend and they're not using it?
They've signed up for digital libraries, bought lots of licenses that aren't used.
Right. And that's HR who would be signing this on behalf of their employers.
And it's a lovely idea. So I'll get a digital library and we've ticked the learning box and everyone's got access to it and they can learn reading body language or how to handle your boss or jam making or whatever. But actually usage is really low and linked to business outcomes is very low.
Right.
I mean, leadership development, spend on leadership development doubled over a period of 12 years and trust in senior leaders fell by a third at the same time. You have to look at that and ask yourself questions. What happened and what could we do differently?
So what happened and what can we do differently?
I want to know the answer.
Yeah, come on. Genuinely, what did happen? That sounds terrible.
Well,
we as businesses investing in leadership development, the leaders are getting worse.
Yes.
Exactly. So what happened?
So what we're not really understanding is what is it that's like to be a leader and therefore what can we make learnable about how to be more effective at it? Explain that in a bit more detail. So the first thing in life is full of tensions. There are things that are impossible to do both of them at the same time. Now you would probably want absolute mercy, but you want absolute justice for everybody else. And we all feel the same. But you can't have absolute mercy for every individual and absolute justice for everybody because they're logically inconsistent. So life and business is full of the same kinds of tensions. So you say to your team, I want immediate results, want this quarter to really deliver on the goals. But I also want you to think long-term and plan for the future and invest in new ideas. I want you to coach people to make them great. But I want you to use your judgment to get on and get the results that you need now. And there are all
Sounds
these
like things. You know me quite well.
Yeah, I've been speaking to some of your people. No other leader does this in the world. You're the only one.
Is that right? Yeah. So you want everything. Then what happens?
So what happens is you then get what's called cognitive dissonance. So you're trying to hold two conflicting thoughts at the same time. Right. And this basically hurts. It hurts your head and you can't do it. So then you have something called displacement. You find reasons to explain it away. The well-being bit doesn't really matter now. I'd leave it for later. It's the bosses. They're impossible. I would try and delegate more, but my boss won't let me. And you find endless excuses and reasons to justify why you can't resolve this impossible tension, which then increases your sense of autonomy or agency. And the last thing you want is your leaders to feel less in control. So then that repeats the cycle and it goes on downwards.
So it's a sort of downward spiral of loss of control.
Yes, because too much is being given on. You're saying these
demanded of people at the same time,
and they're dinged for not doing one thing or the other.
So the sort of leaders above them need to get better at saying this is your priority or this is our priority. Well, is that what you're saying?
No, it's not. What I'm actually saying is the key, the meta skill, is this ability to handle tensions.
Oh, so you've got to train someone to be able to deal with all that at once because it's not going to go away.
It can't. It's logically impossible for it to go away. So it's not as if you...
Why can't it go away?
Because you are going to need short-term and long-term, and you are going to need to look after people and make decisions happen quickly. You know, this is the nature of running a business or running a division or running a team.
Yeah, I accept that.
This is the essence of corporate life.
Yeah. Okay. So it can't go away, so you've got to get better at dealing with it.
And what the research shows really compelling is the meta skill for successful managers and leaders is this ability to navigate tensions. So seeing tensions as a source of strength. So a bicycle without tension is a lump of metal on the ground. It's useless. But tensions is what drives things forward. So actually, how do you mobilize and use these tensions? And what we've done is we've created our team of psychologists. We've reinvigorated an old term, psychological term called attunement, and we've made it learnable. So we've developed it into four practices. So the first is noticing. Don't just do something, stand there. People are forever rushing to take action or rushing to reach conclusions, but actually gathering information. What are people saying? What is not being said? What are the patterns that I'm starting to see going on? And then move to sense making. What does that tell me? How do I understand how the system is working? And then make a choice about what to do. So for example, one of the skills that's really important for leaders is managing intensity. So you have too much intensity, people burn out, but too little, nothing much happens. And the natural force is to reduce intensity. You know, we've got so much to do here, boss. You understand how difficult it is on short resources.
No, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Go on, so you need to manage,
and then the final one is acting on it. And then it's like an infinity cycle. Then you go back to noticing and sense making. And great leaders do this all the time.
So just some noticing.
Sense making.
Choosing.
And acting.
And choosing's around the intensity.
Yes. Or for example, there'll be other choices you make.
What other things?
You might decide whether to address the issue or not. Whether to call it out, how to call it out. You know, do you report and say, I noticed that you've been late for the last three meetings, or do you say, I think you're lazy? You know, at every moment, there are choices that you can say or do nothing or bring people together or...
And all of that together is called attuning.
Attunement, the full cycle.
Yeah, you attune.
And you're constantly dancing around that cycle. And so greatly just do it instinctively, I'm sure you do.
But, I don't know, I'm going to try. That sounds good.
But what's never happened before is to make it learnable.
So this is a new innovation of yours?
Last two or three years.
Yes.
We just had a really interesting study with a company called Galderma, which is a skincare company, comes out of Nestle, and they were preparing for IPOs. They're really driven on business results. And we said, look, if you want business results, you should run a leadership program based on this concept. And they found that the general managers who took part saw growth in top-line revenue and growth in EBITDA. And the ones below also took part and saw growth in the both, and then ended up running case studies that increased market share and sales by over 100% in certain product categories. So they got this fantastic financial result off the back of attunement and one other concept that we taught.
Well, that's a very good case study for you, but I now want to know what the other concept you taught was.
I certainly will.
Because I want to know more about how to get these wonderful results, obviously, as a business owner,
yes,
and entrepreneur.
This is about how do you get people who feel under the
load. How do you get the best from people?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly that. It's totally how do you get the best from people. And there's an interesting study come out today that recruiters are finding it really tough at the market at the moment. And the reason is because more companies are saying, my solution isn't to hire lots of people from outside, but it's actually to grow people from within. Now, the truth is both of them. You need to balance those two together, and you guys do a fantastic job on the recruitment.
I agree, it's both of them.
But what we've got is companies also thinking about how do you make the most of the people you've got. And people feel overwhelmed, they feel exhausted. There's a big issue with absenteeism going on in the market at the moment. More people are off sick. This is a disaster for business. It's a disaster for the economy, and it's totally avoidable. And so the other concept we focused on was what are the conditions you need at work in order to thrive? So companies spend $50 billion a year on corporate wellbeing programs. And I'm not even going to ask you to guess how much impact they have, because you probably know.
$50
billion? Globally.
Wow.
No impact at all. Four different longitudinal studies all show no impact.
Zero impact.
They had 80 measures. Two measures moved. One was intent to change weight, but body mass index hadn't moved at all.
And that's my problem.
You've already been on these corporate wellbeing programs. We've built a diagnostic that shows people what's happening at work that reduces your chance of flourishing, and what can you do to fix it. There also is a report for the manager and the leader as well. But the key is to take responsibility for this.
You say the key is to take responsibility. For who to take responsibility?
For the individual, often in conjunction with the manager, but for the individual to say, work's a nightmare. If you make stress...
Okay, so they say that. So then what happens?
The first thing is recognizing that stress is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Right.
Or can be. And then simply seeing stress as life-enhancing reduces absenteeism by 15% in a study by...
Stress is life-enhancing. Is there any medical evidence of that?
There's lots of medical evidence. Because the opposite of stress is total relaxation. Basically, you get bored. You've got nothing to do.
Yes.
It's like that other
tension.
I
don't want that.
You don't want that?
No.
You can't have enough time and enough imagination. It's not possible. If you've got enough time, you haven't thought of fun things to do. If you've got enough imagination, you haven't got time to do it all. So what you want people to recognize is a certain level of stress. It's called eustress, euphoric stress. Actually makes you perform better, more resilient, more enjoy life, more happy, and all sorts of things. So the first thing is to reframe stress as a good thing, up to a point. And secondly, to reframe work as a source of that good stress, up to quite a significant point.
Sure.
So you meet more people, you have more interesting time.
More challenged.
More challenging. All of that. And therefore, the first bit is to framing the stress. And then we've identified the five conditions that create your chances of flourishing at work, which are certainty, competence, autonomy, belonging, and purpose. And then what we help people understand is which of those are high and low, and which are the ones you can do something about.
So your first model was called attunement. Do you have a name for this one?
Thrive.
Thrive. But the first tenet of thrive is to accept that stress is a good thing, or be sort of persuaded that stress is a good thing.
Yeah, up to a point, it's definitely a good thing. Yeah. I remember years ago doing a session with a guy at BT, an engineer, and he said, I never get stressed at all, he said. So the only thing that ever stresses me is my colleagues getting promoted ahead of me. Yeah. I'm like, well, I think we know why that is, mate, don't we?
Well, they're awake.
They're stressed because they're busy performing. That's why they're getting promoted.
So Did you share that with him, or did you?
In a more polite way, oh, yes, I did.
Yeah. So he needed to switch on his stress.
Well, there was a trade-off. He could feel totally relaxed and calm and zen the whole time, but he wouldn't get promoted.
He wasn't throwing himself in enough.
Or if he wanted to get promoted, he had to experience a bit more stress.
So you mentioned six things there. There's quite a lot, you know, purpose, competence. I mean, where do you begin with those?
So what we do is we measure. So one size fits no one is one of our beliefs. So what you have to do is sheep bits are for sheep. You know, let's focus on what this matters to you. I actually launched this research at Oxford, a longevity forum. One of the people in the audience has started a biotech. Hmm. And she said, I now realize where I went wrong because all these people were exhausted. And I kept reminding them why our work matters so much and why we're changing the world and how we were all in it together. Hmm. So I was dialing up purpose and belonging. But actually, what they were quite high on purpose and belonging. What they were low on was certainty and competence. Mm. So what I should have been doing is more to show them what was happening, the way power rather than the willpower, and more about how they had the skills to be able to get through this and we could all do this together, but based on
I mean, because it doesn't seem to me that much is certain. So what is certainty in this model?
Certainty, well, there's several things as to certainty. So at a meta level, you're obviously right. The world is uncertain, life is uncertain. Who knows what's going on? But there are lots of things you can increase the level of certainty on. And really, it's the small things that happen every day. It might be, we're working with one company where they were closing down a whole lot of sites and they were keeping some other sites open. And they couldn't, for legal reasons, disclose which ones they were closing, which ones they were opening. So people would come to us and go, oh, I'm really uncertain, is my site being closed down? We said, well, have you noticed that some sites they're putting new fiber optic cables in? Yeah, I've seen that. Do you think they're putting them in the sites they're going to close down? Oh, no, maybe not. So actually, you can just pick up information that increases your certainty.
Right.
And there's a great psychological term called confident uncertainty, which is I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I know I can cope with it, whatever it is. And therefore, we help people establish confident uncertainty.
So this model, I mean, how long have you been doing this?
The Thrive piece.
Thrive program.
Again, in a couple of years now. Right. We had a great professor called Amy Edmondson who brought psychological safety to the kind of fore as a concept.
Is she the Harvard Business School
professor?
Yes, that's
right. And she's written the foreword for it and has been very much positively endorsing it.
So she's about psychological safety?
She's about psychological safety. But interesting enough, I said to her when I helped her launch a book and when she was over in the UK, I said, Amy, how much do you think psychological safety has been misappropriated to do the opposite of what was intended? She looked at me on a scale of 1 to 10, I'll give it a 9.
So what do you mean by that? Where are you seeing that? What are you seeing?
Yeah, psychological safety is supposed to be about us having vehement arguments about the issues in order to get to a better outcome. It's in the pursuit of the business, and we can happily disagree. So Pixar, for example, they rip each other's scripts apart. You know, that character doesn't work, and the plot line's boring, and the subplot is irrelevant. And yet they still go out and perfectly friendly afterwards. But it's all done in the spirit of making things better, making a really good film. Now, it's been misappropriate to say, I don't feel safe speaking out about it here because someone might disagree with me or tell me I'm wrong.
Actually,
the whole point is to tell people that you have a different view and why you have a different view and debate those things through. So the idea of being psychologically safe is not about no one's going to say anything that offends me or upsets me. It's the opposite. People are going to challenge me, but not as me, as the ideas or the concept or the product or the marketing strategy or the digital route or whatever else.
Sure, it's not the person you're challenging, it's the idea or the direction of travel or whatever, isn't it? I mean, I suppose they might be giving voice to it.
The risk of using a sporting analogy, if someone's running up the pitch, they're chasing the ball, not you, but you can think it's you that they're chasing.
Yeah. So is that a problem? Do you see it a lot in business that people are too sort of tentative around people's feelings and ideas when they should be more
absolutely.
More
I think this is
robust.
You'd be taking care and become overdone strength. And actually caring is being frank and being candid and saying things as you see them and reporting. Very interesting work on feedback, for example. So everyone says we want to have more feedback, we want a feedback culture. I remember going to see Sears, big retailer in the States.
I remember, yeah.
And they just won a award for the most feedback ever given and received in a company. I'm like, are you sure that's a good thing? And they're like, well, we won the award, didn't we? Well, and we know what happened to Sears.
Didn't well, that's why I said I remember.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So feedback. Sears, for our younger listeners, what happened to Sears?
Well, they went into administration.
They don't
chapter 11,
anymore,
I think.
Do they? Yeah.
So feedback in itself can be really helpful, but it can do an immense damage. And so what we've done is break it down into what's the bits of feedback that work. So describing things really helpful. So I noticed that you put sources on all your charts. I noticed that when the CEO asked you a question, you asked a question back. And then you can say, this is what it tells me. So you can then own the interpretation. It tells me you're very rigorous. It tells me you're a thorough researcher, or it tells me you're willing to ask questions to power or whatever it might be. Now, you then on the receiving end can go, either I disagree with the facts, half the charts didn't have sources or someone else put them there, or you can agree with the facts, but actually there's a different reason for it. But because by breaking down the what you've noticed and described and how you've interpreted it, you end up having a much more constructive conversation.
Yeah, feedback people find difficult to digest, don't they? Someone said on our podcast that someone said to him, you know, feedback is like getting a jumper from an aunt. You can always put it in a drawer and forget about it, which I thought was quite good. But yes, you know, that's the other side of it. You don't have to take it on. I mean, it's just information in a way, isn't it?
It's useful information if it's what someone's noticed. Yeah. So the more factual you can make it, the better off.
Okay, more factual. So it's based on what you've actually noticed.
Yes.
It's indisputable. You know, if someone had a video and recorded exactly.
Or if you dispute it, you can at least have a discussion about what happened.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed that you didn't speak for the first half hour of the meeting. Oh, actually, I did. I said at the beginning X, Y, and Z. And you can agree or disagree on the facts. Usually there's fairly firm agreement on it. But that then gives you a base from which to say, well, because you didn't speak for that long, I think so the clients were worried that you weren't part of the team, or you didn't bring enormous value, or didn't give as much respect when you did speak about X, Y, or Z at a later stage. Mm. Now, the other person can then change their view on the interpretation, but at least you separated the event from the interpretation of it.
So just listening to you, Octavius, you're doing a lot of analysis of when I was thinking about how you handled the bank who turned his back on you to go to the coffee. You're doing a lot of analysis in the room of people's behavior and what's going on. From their body language and who says what in what order. And is this something I think you're going to answer this question, so that we should all be much more conscious and aware of.
Well, the basic principle of what MindGym exists to do is psychology can solve most of the world's problems.
Say that again.
Psychology, understanding human behavior, can solve most of the world's problems. You know, loneliness, depression, bullying, polarization, they're all psychological issues.
Conflict,
absolutely. Mm. And they can also solve most of the issues at work. So if you could equip people with practical, useful psychology, their lives would be a whole lot better, and their working lives would be a whole lot better, and their businesses would be a lot more successful. So what we do is equip people with that psychology so they can do it themselves.
A lot of young people are studying psychology now. Does that give you hope that the next generation of managers and leaders will be better, or are they reading the wrong stuff?
It gives me great hope.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, psychology has now become a really mainstream. When we started, I remember saying to a client once, he said, what do you do? I said, we bring psychology to help you grow your business. He said, you know my view of psychologists? I said, no. He said, I think they're like bidets in bathrooms. They add a touch of class, but no one knows what to do with them. So that was put down on psychology. I think that's changed a lot.
But do you recruit psychologists?
You don't recruit lots of psychologists.
We're
very data-driven. So we recruit also psychometricians. So we're very excited. We've got the world's leading IP on predictive assessments. So you want to predict whether someone will be a good leader or a manager or what they'll be capable of. We have got the most reliable diagnostic in the world for doing that.
And what's that involve? So if I want to do this diagnostic... Yes. Bit late for me, but how would I go about
some of the people you're busy finding for your clients?
Yeah, well, it might be or wanting to promote or
so exactly
how,
that.
So if someone in this thing wants to do that, how do they go about it? Website.
So if you're a company and you wanted to find out who's most likely to become an effective leader or who's most likely to do some particular skill, be more agile in their working or better at accountability or more likely to collaborate, we've got the data that shows what are the skills and what are the personality traits that will most likely lead to that outcome.
Okay, give us some clues. So what's the data throwing up?
If you want people who are accountable, you want people who are ambitious, for example. So ambition is really strongly related to...
Why is that?
What the data says. I'm not sure I can give you the answer to that.
So an ambitious person is more likely to be accountable.
My hypothesis as to why that matters is because they want to succeed, and therefore they want to be seen to succeed, and therefore they take ownership for things that they're asked to do. That would be high. I can't prove that, but that's my hypothesis.
It's very interesting. We had a guest recently who didn't do very well at school, but he said, I've always loved responsibility. And he's been incredibly successful.
Probably runs quite ambitious.
So he must have sort of linked to that. I remember that was a striking remark. So that's one. Is there any other things that... Was it the psychometrician?
Yeah, a psychometrician is someone who does the data for diagnostics.
Yeah, so the psychometrics. What else? This is interesting. What else are they telling us? So that's one example. Any others?
The
You know, in terms of leaders?
In terms of leaders, one of the things that's really strong for leadership is emotional self-regulation. So right. we did an interesting study. It's also one of those diagnostic, but it's an interesting study for partners of professional services firms on what was the characteristic that most distinguished those who were more successful, bill the most hours, sold the most business than the rest. It wasn't cognitive ability, how smart they were. It wasn't how great a communicator they were or how collaborative they were. It was their emotional self-regulation. It's their ability to come into the meeting with you, not carrying in the mood from the meeting they just had before. And this comes back to, you asked about certainty at work. The big part of certainty is how your boss treats you. So if your boss turns up in a mood, does that affect what's going to happen? Or is your boss always quite calm and ready and listens to you and present? In which case, you're pretty certain you know what's going to happen as a result. So the boss's ability to self-regulate greatly increases certainty, which then increases well-being and the chances of people thrive and so on and so forth.
So emotional self-regulation. So they're not wondering what sort of boss is going to turn up today, but exactly. It's kinds of... consistent, like McDonald's.
Well,
you get what
certainly
you're
fairly level.
Yeah. Yes. How do you achieve emotional self-regulation? Is that just sort of something some people don't have, you can learn?
All these
how
things
do you
learnable.
Learn it?
Yeah. You learn it by thinking about what are your triggers and alarm calls. So when are you likely to get into an emotional state? Your emotional state is roused and you're seeing red mist, or you're angry or talking too fast, or you're whatever it is that you normally do in those moments. Therefore, you can then say, well, at this moment, I'm not self-regulated, so I need to go for a walk or delay this meeting or not make this decision now. And therefore, you start to notice the triggers and then you start to choose to behave differently, usually by deferring or delaying.
Another guest was talking about information diet, the importance of having an information diet because of all the toxicity that's being sort of directed at us on social media and, you know, click on this or you're getting served sort of not the nicest of things. And how do we get away from that in this world? Have you got any thoughts on that?
There's great research on happiness.
Yeah.
And there's Lara Crumb, who's a student of another brilliant psychologist called Alan, who talks about intrinsic and extrinsic motivations and how we draw our strength. The more we draw from intrinsic motivations, the pleasure of the breeze on our face or the joy of good company or whatever it is that we are actually enjoying in the moment or a range of moments.
We call that intrinsic.
Intrinsic, as opposed to external validation. So compare and despair might be your motto. So the more you go on social media and discover that someone's looking more glamorous or more beautiful or going to more parties or something you wish you weren't, the more you're going to be in a funk.
Right.
So same comes with the news cycle. So if you tend to be happier if you're reading books, particularly novels, than if you are following daily news clicks and clickbait.
So reading novels is a good thing.
Reading novels promotes empathy. So you're more likely to be empathetic and understand other people.
Rather than business books.
I'm afraid so. Business books are helpful for another reason.
I've just written a business book. Should have written a novel.
I wrote four books on holiday just now. Only one was a novel. So
Well, I'm going to write a novel next. That's good. So you're helping with well-being and with performance and with leadership. What next for Mind Gym? How do you see your company evolving from here?
We're very excited indeed because what we're seeing is all the pieces come together. So we've developed all these great units from the bite-sized workout and the precision coaching and the diagnostics, and we're now piecing them together into one talent ecosystem, for want of a better word. And therefore, we think there's an enormous opportunity for companies who want to make their talent development, learning and development culture, whatever they choose to call it, more cost-effective by focusing on the few things that will deliver the greatest impact and making sure they all fit together. So the diagnostic feeds into the coaching, which feeds into the workshops, which feeds into the digital learning, and can be hyper-personalized. So you can give people what they need at the moment they need in order to drive the business outcomes you're trying to
do. How do you do that? I like the word hyper-personalized, if it's one word, it's probably two. But how do you do that? Is it digital or is it through other methods?
It's a combination. So you might take our diagnostic, the world's most validated one, and it tells you that the things you need to get better at are decision-making. And there might be some self-directed e-learning on decision-making, which we've designed. And again, all our learning has been tested with 5 million people, so it's got to quite a high proof point.
So the diagnostic covers those six areas, is it?
It covers a range of areas, more than that.
Okay.
To be fair, there are two diagnostics. One covers specifically the six areas, and one covers a broader range, which is more about leadership. And what we've got is, so what you might then, you take complete the diagnostic, it gives you your profile, it gives you some maybe some digital learning that you can go to immediately, specifically targeted for you. It can also direct you to certain bite-sized workshops, our 90-minute workshops, and say, actually, the one on courageous conversations will really help you. We've also got a coach for tough conversations called Leo, who's trained in MindGym, who will help you practice. And is audiovisual.
So is Leo a real person, not a robot?
Leo's a bot.
All right. Yeah. So you can talk to Leo.
You watch Leo and you describe the person. It's great because you describe the person. They're very argumentative or they're very passive or they...
The person you want to get better at dealing with.
Yes. Oh. And you describe a situation. They're underperforming or they're overperforming or they're slacked off or whatever.
All right.
And then you practice it live.
Well, Leo adopts the role of that yes. person.
Exactly. Mm. And then Leo responds as that person would. And at the end, Leo gives you feedback and says, this is the things you said that were really good. And these are the things you could have done differently that would have got you to a
should
better
we
outcome.
Care about Leo's feedback? Because Leo isn't a person.
Well, I think we should care about Leo's feedback much more because they're not pushing their own biases or assumptions about what's right.
Yeah, they don't have an agenda.
And they're listening to you 100% of the time. So then Leo will also create more data that will then tell you, in light of this, what you really need to get good at is goal setting or feedback or whatever else it happens to be. And then you can point to other... Or you get your coaching and your coach gets this feedback about you, so knows where to start the conversation rather than dancing around.
How did Leo learn his or their trade?
We taught it all the MindGym content. We've got 25 years of IP, as I said, tested with 5 million people. And we taught Leo all the content we've got.
Is Leo going to put you out of a job, Octavius?
AI is going to transform the world of work. It's going to make things, we're going to need probably fewer people with higher skills that are more critical to the business. And a lot of jobs are going to disappear and change or form into new kinds of jobs. And so we're certainly seeing that AI can change the nature of business, probably not as quickly as people had anticipated, but it's coming for sure. And it's changing our business because we're getting able to provide the same content through different routes. So as I said, we do it self-directed, we do it large-scale events, small-scale events, one-to-one coaching, and now through AI. And different people in different situations will require a mix of these if you want to change behavior. But it's still the case that 75% of people's P&L is people.
Sure.
And if you don't realize that...
the costs.
It may cut costs, but you still need to get the most from that 75%.
Yeah, exactly. It's really important. So how long has Leo been sort of at work?
Leo's just arrived.
Leo's new. And what's the response been from the first sort of guinea pigs?
Well, the people who've used it love it.
Oh, good.
What's interesting is how many companies are nervous and anxious. They're legal departments. So the HR departments, the leaders really want it. But the legal departments are getting in the way.
So what are the legal departments?
Department didn't like it because they were worried that the AI coach might say something that contravened company policy. Now, there are lots of safeguards. Now, there are lots of ways. There are trigger words that Leo says, I'm afraid that's not acceptable and you can't use that. And there are ways that Leo will actually walk out of the room if you...
The legal department's worried that Leo might say something that would then result in them being sued,
yes.
I suppose.
That's exactly right. But we've actually got all the precautions.
And Leo's behaves quite well so far.
Leo is impeccable.
You could just
much
program
than
Leo not to say anything. You might get a suit.
We have.
It's much easier to do that with a bot than a person.
But I remember years ago, legal departments not wanting people to have email because they might use it for personal reasons. I mean, legal departments aren't always the first to embrace new technology.
No, that's probably an understatement. Yes. Okay. So you see AI obviously changing a lot. But you see a constant in psychology being important, I'm hearing.
So when psychology meets technology, that's when you get the real magic. And so what you want to do is help people become more effective at dealing with other people and using technology to make that happen.
So when technology meets psychology, you get the real magic. I think that's a very good point to finish our conversation. Thank you very much, Octavius. I'm going to ask you two questions that I ask everybody. And the first is, what gets you up on a Monday morning?
I love what I do. I've loved it since I started doing it. I love it now. So Monday is like every other day for me. It's just exciting to get out there and try and change the way the world thinks.
That's very good, because we love Mondays.
Yes.
So the last question I'm going to ask you is a question that's in my interview book, Why You?, which is, where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Well, I see the future of this market is a very different kind of model, where you've got an integrated solution that companies, if you like, outsource to, in the way that lots of marketing departments have an expert outsource partner who's an in-source partner who provides the specialist knowledge, who provides the data, and is integrated with the company. The future of HR, I think, is going to move in this direction. Now, some of the more operational bits of HR, like payroll and pensions management, has already been outsourced. But the next stage is the talent part. And that's where I think we can bring incredible expertise, and I'm phenomenally excited. I think the best is yet to come.
Well, I wish you continued success, and I'll have to get you back in 5 years' time to see how that's evolved. Thanks very much for coming to talk to me.
Thanks very much.
Enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you, Octavius, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed, Octavius, or Mind Gym, all links are in the show notes. See you next time.